surgeons to nurses. Minnesota has four levels. Thank you so much.
Senators, thank you for having us tonight. I want to make a plea that...
State your name for the record and offer your testimony.
I'm Dr. Kevin Crosston from North Memorial. I want to make a plea tonight. The Medicaid cuts, the 10% cut to our facilities, we've survived these years with that. But as trauma centers, and particularly as level one trauma centers, the amount of resource that's required to keep our doors open and keep a level of readiness to provide care for your patients is above and beyond what other facilities in the state have to maintain. We're also the basis for the emergency management system, and when there are mass casualty events or other events, the level one trauma centers are what provide that support. North Memorial in particular, I can speak to that. Dr. Cumming can speak for Hennepin, but North Memorial has an ambulance service that provides a lot of pre-hospital care throughout the state of Minnesota, and a helicopter service that brings patients down into the metro also for victims of trauma. We're sort of double penalized. This is a poorly compensated patient group that we care for, and on top of that, we're part of this. We're also a part of this Medicaid cut. So really, what we're looking at or what we're asking for is just to consider for the length of the bill, which I believe is 2016 or 2015, to reverse that 10% cut for the three level one trauma centers to help support the financial resources that it takes to run our business.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I was directed to kind of focus my comments a little bit on what some of those resources Dr. Crosston alluded to. For the record, my name is Dr. John Cumming, and I'm a trauma critical care surgeon at Hennepin County Medical Center, and I'm also the chair of the American College of Surgeons State Committee on Trauma. And the level one trauma centers bring to bear as far as resources on care of injured patient is really tremendous. There is three main areas in which trauma centers have additional requirements of resources over that of many of the other hospitals in the statewide trauma system, and they are really basically emergency preparedness, education, and research. These are all requirements that are laid out in the American College of Surgeons document for level one verification. And so they are actual requirements. It's not that we could, do away with the research component or the education component or whatever. These are all requirements that are put forth and that need to be met in order to reach the highest level of verification, level one trauma center. And some of the resources that we have, just to kind of highlight some of it, and many of you already know, but we have 24/7 in-house surgeon coverage. When I'm on call down at the hospital, I'm in the hospital for 24 hours straight. I'm immediately available at all times for the highest level of injured patient. This obviously is a model that produces the best outcomes for the citizens of our state, those that are the most critically injured and require a surgeon immediately at their side to perform whatever life-saving measures are necessary. We also, along with that, then have OR availability, operating room availability, 24/7. We have two crews available. There's one in-house and one also immediately available. There's neurosurgery and interventional radiology coverage. And those are also immediately available and or in-house. In addition, the emergency department obviously maintains a very high level of preparedness at our level one trauma centers, both with regard to management of multiple victims, but also disaster management, such as what occurred with the 35W bridge collapse. They also maintain a lot of other infrastructure services that are unique to some hospitals. Hennepin, for example, has poison control. Education, as part of being a level one trauma center, we are required to provide education to the hospitals throughout the state. and help providers with maintaining up-to-date status on their education with for care of the injured patient. We do a lot of outreach and then research as well. The research obviously impacts local community, but also outcomes across the nation. And so these are all vital resources and vital things to our, for the Level 1 trauma centers to maintain that verification. And therefore, we strongly feel that the exemption would be warranted for these centers. Does anybody have any questions at all?
Thank you. I was going to ask if Senator Hayden had any additional comments, any questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 176? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 176 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Before I go up, I have the next couple of bills, a couple more ambulance-type bills, and then the omnibus bill. Did members have any questions they'd like me to answer prior on the general approach that we're going to be taking before I head up? All right.
Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair and members, I have first Senate File 29. Senate File 29 is an ambulance rate cut sunset. In the last budget bill, ambulance providers took a rate cut along with many other types of providers of 4.5%. But ambulance was unique in that this was permanent with no sunset. These were, I think, largely intended to be sunset to get us through incredibly difficult budget times, but this one was not sunset, and what Senate File 29 does is makes it so that the sunset of the cut would be effective June 30th of this year and restore that cut. Here with me representing the Minnesota Ambulance Association is Buck McElpin to give you some more details of this bill and the impact.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, Buck McElpin with Minnesota Ambulance Association tonight. This is something that's came up from our association. It was an initiative. We wanted to move forward this year. Some of our rural ambulance services, we forget that they, even though some of them do 150 runs a year, about 75 to 80% of their payer mix can be Medicare and Medicaid. They're paid about 72% below some of their cost on average for those payer mixes. So although at times 4.5% doesn't sound like a lot of money to them, it is. Even systems our size, where I work with North Memorial, we have quite a medical assistance mix in the metro area, too. And just some rough numbers, as systems like ours, this was about a $600,000 cut. St. Paul Fire, about $500,000. Alina, about $400,000. And these are systems where we operate small rural volunteer services, too. And still about 62% of Minnesota's EMS is volunteer. So this is something the association asked us to bring forward this year, and we'd appreciate your support.
With that, we'd stand for any questions, Madam Chair.
Members, any questions? Discussion? Hearing none. Senator Lurie, do you have a motion?
I move that Senate File 29 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I next have Senate File 278, another Minnesota ambulance Association bill. This is a Minnesota Ambulance Association appropriation specified. This was a piece that we did in a rider last year, and it allowed for the Minnesota Ambulance Association to get a $10,000 appropriation to complete an uncompensated care study. And this bill is really a technical clarification that this is a one-time appropriation to the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I don't, you know, that's all it says is this is a one-time appropriation, so it wouldn't be ongoing. Pretty straightforward. With that, I'd move that Senate File 278 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion. Stand for any questions. Oh, actually, yeah, there wouldn't necessarily, there isn't a budget implication. So let me revise my motion. I move that Senate File 278 be recommended to pass.
Senator Lurie, I believe there is a fiscal implication.
Is there?
Madam Chair and Senator Lurie, the reason this bill is being talked about is that in the forecast that $10,000 is ongoing without the language in the bill. So it does save $10,000 each
year. So it does save $10,000 a year. Well, let's do this. This did go to the floor in the House, and I guess we've done this in the past, and I'll try to see what the House does, but maybe we can dual track this and allow it to go on, and if we care to hear it in other committees and pass it on the floor, we can, and we can track the savings here, but dual track it in that we will lay it on the table here for possible inclusion, but also, so my motion would be that Senate File 278 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance and also be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Health and Human Services bill.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries, and the bill it will be laid over and dual tracked.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Okay, so that moves us to the main order of business for the night. And this is going to be Senate File 1034. And before we get started, as per my description earlier, I would like to move the A13 amendment. That's the one you'll find in your package, members. And this would be an author's amendment. This is the first time this has been heard. So I'd move the A13 amendment.
Senator Lurie moves the A13 amendment. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the question is on the motion of Senator Lurie on A13. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries. Amendment is adopted. Senator Lurie?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I also have the KC8 amendment. Has that been passed out to members as well? This would also be an author's amendment. It was intended to have been in the bill and allows for medical assistance to continue up to, for children under age 19 to continue up to 275% of the federal poverty level. That's actually a maintenance of effort requirement of the feds. This was intended to be in the bill and somehow was inadvertently omitted. And so I would move the KC8 amendment as well.
Senator Lurie moves the KC8 amendment. Any discussion? Any members' questions? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. Motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Senator Lurie?
Okay. And then, just again, to reiterate, the A13 amendment has been engrossed into the bill. The A8, by the way, because it was an omission, is not engrossed, so you won't find it. But it is there for members to read. Other than the A8, the entirety of the bill that is before us is this revisor's DD-1233 bill that is before us, and we're going to start picking through it. Maybe one of the best ways this index is a bit confusing to find things in this bill. I will admit that it is possible to crosswalk, but another helpful guide for members, the governor's change pages that I said are in the beginning of your budget books, I can help guide you to each of the items that we're going to be going over tonight The Medicaid eligibility and enrollment changes are page 4 in the governor's change pages. The expansion of Medicaid to maintain coverage for children and pregnant women up to 275% of federal poverty is page 7 of those change pages. And we can repeat this anytime, too, as well, if members are struggling. But the Affordable Care Act application fee for provider screening is page 102 of the governor's change pages. The administration and systems resources for all health care coverage expansions is page 14 of the budget governor's change pages. Appeals is page 131. And the 340B drug reimbursement policies are page 19 of the governor's change pages. And so with that, I'll ask Assistant Commissioner Leitz from the Department of Human Services to start with stepping us through these portions of the governor's budget bill.
Mr. Leitz, welcome to
the committee. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Scott Leitz from the Department of Human Services. The first portion that I'd like to walk you through relates to changes that are required under the implementation of the Affordable Care Act related to eligibility and enrollment for our programs. These are contained in Article 1, primarily contained in Article 1 of the bill. And as Senator Laurie pointed out, they're also on the change pages that I think you have in front of them, page 4 primarily. The first item in this is a new methodology to calculate income. It's called the MAGI methodology. One of the characteristics of the Affordable Care Act is a requirement that states implement a new strategy to determine financial eligibility for Medicaid applicants and enrollees. It's called the MAGI methodology. It generally follows the IRS tax code in defining who is included in a household unit and also what income is counted for the purposes of eligibility. MAGI is also used to determine eligibility in the subsidy amounts for advanced premium tax credits as well through the exchange. There are certain populations that are subject to the MAGI methodology. That would be pregnant women and infants, children, parents, and the adult group who is the adult expansion group up to 133% of poverty. So that's the sort of MAGI methodology portion of this. The second element is the elimination of asset tests. The MAGI methodology does not permit an asset test. And so for Minnesota, what that means is that we are eliminating under the bill the Medicaid asset test for parents under this bill. Just a couple additional pieces here. Under the new rules, individuals and families who filed taxes household membership and income will be determined using the same rules used for figuring taxable income on a 1040 tax form. For very low-income individuals and families who don't file taxes, Medicaid retains its historic rules for household composition, which is based on family relationships, but income counting follows the IRS tax rules. And then finally, the income disregards that apply to the current net income formula are eliminated. And so that's where we see you oftentimes heard of the eligibility at 133 or 138, and that's because of that 5% income disregard. This section of the bill also requires that applications make some changes to how we must accept applications for Medicaid coverage. We have to accept them under the bill through the following methods: online, by mail, by phone, or in person. And the applications must be verified using electronic data. And we will have access to the Federal Data Hub, which will query a number of federal databases to verify things such as Social Security numbers, citizenship, immigration status. And then we will be supplementing this with this federal data with state sources such as the quarterly wage data and unemployment information from DEED. As part of this. Madam Chair, the second major area relates to renewal changes that are required under the law. The first is that we'll be moving to 12-month eligibility periods for the MAGI populations. What this means is that for Minnesota, we'll be extending what is currently our 6-month eligibility periods that are currently in place for MAGI populations that's families with kids and adults without children, to 12 months. We're also required to do what are called ex parte renewals. This requirement around renewal includes a requirement for an ex parte review under which DHS must use electronic data and try to confirm and to try and confirm continued eligibility for individuals before we ask a client for any new information. So this is a way to ensure continuity of coverage for individuals. If the electronic data check that we're required to do indicates that an enrollee is still eligible for Medicaid, we have to process that renewal without asking the enrollee for additional data or any additional forms. And then finally, there's a requirement for pre-populated renewal forms. So if DHS cannot confirm continued eligibility for renewal based on the electronic data sources, we must provide the data we have to pre-populate a renewal form and then send it to the client for completion. That's also included in this section. Third area of change is related to the treatment of former foster care children. The ACA includes a provision that expands coverage for children who are participating in foster care and who leave foster care on or after they turn the age of 18. States are required to cover these former foster care youths in Medicaid until their 26th birthday. A fourth area relates to spousal empowerment extended to all home and community-based waiver recipients. Beginning January 1st of 2014 and for a period of 5 years, the ACA requires states to apply certain income and asset rules when determining Medicaid eligibility for people requesting payment of home and community-based services through a waiver program. Minnesota currently applies these rules to the elderly waiver, but not to the disability waivers. Spousal impoverishment rules are designed to protect a certain amount of a married couple's income and assets for the spouse of the person who requires long-term services. And so for people applying for coverage through a disability waiver, the spousal impoverishment rules will replace what's called the deeming waiver. A fifth element in this section of the bill, Madam Chair, is presumptive eligibility at hospitals. The Affordable Care Act requires DHS to allow hospitals to do presumptive eligibility determinations for Medicaid if they elect to do so. What presumptive eligibility is it involves a small set of data about an applicant being collected at a hospital at the time of service to do a preliminary and temporary eligibility determination. Recent federal rules do allow DHS to exercise a fair amount of control over how the presumptive eligibility process will work and what types of applicants it will apply to. And the supplemental budget of the governor recognizes that the changes required to implement this provision will not be in place until January of 2015. So all told, Madam Chair, the changes to the enrollment and renewal processes, extending coverage of foster children until age 26 and permitting hospitals to presume eligibility will result in lower turnover and therefore higher enrollment counts. Together, these changes result in an additional forecasted average monthly enrollment of around 61,000 people by 2016, a cost to the general fund of $138 million for the 2014-15 biennium and $309 million for the 2016-2017 biennium. Madam Chair, the next section relates to expanding or maintaining coverage for children and pregnant women in medical assistance.
Senator Lurie?
We should take each of these as a separate budget section and have a discussion about them, I think would be a good, because there was a lot of changes just in the eligibility and enrollment. So maybe
Senator Benson? Thank you, Senator Lurie.
Appreciate the process clarification. Yes. Thank you. And Mr. Leitz, I think you probably, Madam Chair, Mr. Leitz, I think you probably gave an explanation, but if you could just target in for me what happens with the tails. I'm on page 6 and we get up to $309 million by the 2017. Is that just because we're projecting that much enrollment in MA? And where are those people now? I don't think our population's going to grow that much. I guess what's behind those numbers?
Commissioner Leitz.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, it is related to enrollment growth, and it really comes from two spots. One is that individuals will, because of the requirement for health insurance coverage, the estimates here presume that we'll have increased enrollment due to that requirement being in place. The second really relates to the fact that that there's an assumption that with the existence of the health insurance exchange of MinSure, that there will be more people coming in through that mechanism as well, in combination with the mandate. So you have a growth of individuals coming in who will be covered.
Okay. Senator Benson? And
Madam Chair and Mr. Leitz, I had a question about the householding. Because right now, if two people are living in the same house and they file separate tax returns, the IRS doesn't consider them a household. In our current MA programs, if there are two adults living in the house and one has children, do we count all the assets in the household or only if they're married? Can you help me understand if there will be changes because of that?
Mr. Leitz.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, I'm going to ask Susan Hammerston to come up and help you with that question.
Ms. Hammerstein, welcome to the committee. Can you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, I'm Susan Hammerstein, DHS. The household composition rules are determined. If you are a tax filer, we use the tax filer definition of a household. So in your first example, Senator, two adults living in the same household but filing taxes separately would be counted as two households, each containing one person. If you're not a tax filer, as many Medicaid recipients are not because they are below the tax filing threshold, then we revert back to our old familiar relationship household composition rules.
Okay, so
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, if I could then clarify. So currently, if there are two people living in the household and they, you know, share a common home and their income and assets are counted together for purposes of MA, is that an accurate understanding?
Ms. Hammerstein?
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, I think we would need to know more about the people who are living together. Do they have a child together? Are they married? Are they just simply in the household together?
Okay, but
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, in the case that I'll just get really specific so that I have some sort of concrete example. Two people living together, they have a child in common. They might file separate tax returns, but under current policy, would all of their assets be counted? All of their income be counted?
Ms. Hammerstein,
Madam Chair, Senator Benson. Again, if they are the biological parents of the child together, then yes, they would all be counted together if they all had a basis of eligibility in Medicaid.
Okay.
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, so under the new policy, if they filed taxes separately, then they're considered two separate households, regardless of commonality of address or any other connection.
Yes, Hammerstein. Madam Chair, Senator Benson, if they are eligible to file taxes separately, they could.
Commissioner Leitz or Senator Lurie?
Madam Chair, an additional clarification. Those are the, just according to the MAGI standards that have now been imposed by the Fed. So this is just clarifying what the new eligibility requirements for Medicaid and all plans sold through the exchange as well will be, using this new federal standard that's going to apply nationwide.
Madam Chair and Senator Lurie, thank you. I just wanted to clarify that
absolutely.
We were changing a Minnesota policy, and I wanted to make sure I understood the details. And Madam
Senator
Chair and Senator Lurie, the foster children who will remain MA eligible until the age of 26, it looks to me like that might be some of the same population we were talking about this morning. Who needed emergency medical care. And so I'm wondering if we're getting some overlap. Does that look like something that would be a reasonable assumption?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, I'm going back to Senator Kiffmeyer's questions about how we were serving that population within the context of homelessness grants. And certainly, you know, I actually had that thought this morning of whether it would benefit the conversation or not. I think that the need for homeless services for youth and youth aging out of foster care is a different issue than whether or not they have health care. And truthfully, I think of this extension for youth aging out of foster care to be able to maintain Medicaid coverage up to age 26 as right akin to the requirement that that parents are able to carry their children to age 26. I mean, these foster youth, you know, we the public are stepping in the role as parent for these individuals, and so it's a similar thing. But for the homelessness grants, I think there's, you know, still a demonstrated clear need for supportive housing options for this still vulnerable population. But the assurance that they will have access to health care is a huge step, and they do work hand in hand.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Lurie or Commissioner Leitz, if you would like to continue with
Well, I mean, I don't know if members questions. Want to have more questions about the eligibility and enrollment changes. Otherwise, we can move to the expansion of MA to maintain coverage for children and pregnant women up to 275. I guess we will do that. Move to expansion of MA for pregnant women and children up to 275% of federal poverty level. Again, the change page, where you'll find that is page 7 in the governor's change pages. And we'll leave it at that. You can find it in the – I found it a little while ago in the index, too, so that you could reference it in the actual language. But with that, we'll turn it over to Mr. Leitz.
Madam Chair and members, this item really – what this does is to maintain coverage for children and pregnant women in medical assistance to 275% of the federal poverty level. Our interpretation of the eligibility maintenance of effort provisions included in the Affordable Care Act has been that Minnesota is required to maintain Medicaid coverage for pregnant women and kids aged 2 to 18 with incomes up to 275% of poverty in order to avoid the loss of CHIP funds to the state. And so that's what this item does. I want to pause for just a second to talk a little bit about the fiscal estimate on this. We had an estimate in the current supplemental budget, which was an estimate that this item would cover about a little over 100,000 kids and pregnant women by 2016. About 60,000 would move, who are currently eligible for Minnesota Care would move over, and about 41,000 would be newly eligible for coverage with a net cost of about $75 million for the biennium. What we based that estimate on information from Jonathan Gruber, consultant with Minsure. He updated that estimate in late February, and his revised figures showed that there were about 40,000 fewer children under 275 of the federal poverty line than had been earlier projected, which reduces the expected enrollment. The staff at DHS who are working on the fiscal estimates for the governor's supplemental budget were not aware this estimate had changed. And so this is going to be revised. The governor's budget is going to be revised to represent the corrected enrollment figures. So this, rather than providing coverage for around 100,000 kids, will be about 70,000 kids and pregnant women, about 10,000 newly eligible, about 60,000 moving over from Minnesota Care. And this lowers the net cost by about $47 million from from a net cost of about $75 million to a net cost of about $28 million for the biennium.
Members, any questions? Commissioner Leitz, just clarification, where the funding would come from and would follow, was it currently under Health Access Fund and then moving to General Fund? Where does it follow the client to a different program? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the funding, this item produces a savings in the Health Care Access Fund because of the movement of children from Minnesota Care to the Medical Assistance Program. and has a net cost and has a cost to the general fund because of the movement onto that.
But he just said that there is miscalculated.
Any other questions on this section? We can proceed to the next one then. Senator Lori?
The next one would be the application fee for provider screenings. That's the next ACA compliance issue. You'll find it on page 102 of the governor's change pages.
Is that yours?
Application fee for providers. Senator Benson? I believe it's 102?
Yes, page 102 of the governor's change pages will get you to. Do you know what it's in here? What section?
It's Article 5.
Okay, section
Article
6.
5, Section 6.
In the large bill, it'll be Article 5, Section 6, which should be page 207. Application fee, yes. It begins at the bottom of page 207. Goes on to page 208 if members want to try.
102.
Thank you.
So with that, I've got Office Inspector General Jerry Kerber.
Mr. Kerber?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Jerry Kerber from the Inspector General's Office at the Department of Human Services, and I'll talk about this section. You found it. I also want to just talk about it in the context of two others. The challenge was put to me earlier by Senator Lori to kind of describe how we can possibly provide, identify some savings related to this issue, and so I want to talk about it in that context. But this is a provider screening requirement that's been required under the Affordable Care Act since 2011, and we haven't been in compliance with it. We need to get up to speed. We had a number of proposals over the years that didn't pass, and so this is kind of getting us caught up. What we're required to do is some pre- and post-enrollment screening of newly enrolled providers. It doesn't cover everybody. It excludes solo practitioners, and it excludes anybody who's already enrolled as a Medicare provider, and it excludes physicians, clinics from paying a fee. But there is a fee involved in this, and it's $532 a year. The fee does not quite cover the cost for the screenings, pre- and post-enrollment screenings that we're going to have to do. And so that's what I want to just kind of talk real quickly about two other provisions, and then we can kind of circle back and talk in greater detail. The second one that's related to this is an expansion of our SIRS, our Surveillance and Integrity Review section. When we do these screenings, the pre-enrollment screening is intended to prevent providers who aren't prepared or are not capable or not competent or not credentialed, really, essentially, to become enrolled in the program. So we don't really have savings from that because the people who are going to be getting services will just not be able to get services from this provider who's not eligible. They'll be going to somebody else. But we also have a post-enrollment inspection. And with that, we anticipate that we will be finding some problems. And some problems with overpayment issues. And we're anticipating that we'll be seeing that maybe as high as 10% of the cases of these new enrollees. So those programs that we find enrollment issues, or excuse me, where we find overpayment issues, need to be referred for a full SIRS investigation, a Medicaid fraud investigation. And so the second proposal here is just to expand that unit by 6 people. We currently have 10 of those investigators who look at we have, 800,000 people getting these services. There's 154,000 healthcare providers, 78 different types of providers, and we have 10 investigators who look at overpayment issues. And so the second part of this is really expanding that by only 6 people, and that's going to help us do some follow-up to that post-enrollment visit. And then the third provision, and that second one is in Article 5 also, and it's change page 110. And the third provision that's very related to this is we are going to be increasing, and there isn't language to go with this, but we're going to be increasing our recovery efforts significantly in 3 different areas. Currently, when a provider is found to have received more money than they were due, and they continue in business, we can recoup those funds by decreasing the payments made out into the future. But when providers go out of business, we have some trouble there. One of the provisions that we have here is to modify our surety bond authority. Right now, we have the authority to require surety bonds of PCA providers, for instance. And up until last summer, we never collected on one. Sometimes we find that there were overpayments, there were false billing issues, and we go after that provider only to find them dissipate, and we're unable to get that money back. But if they have a surety bond, then we get some of that money back. There's been a requirement in the law for a number of years that they have those, but because we never ever collected on any of them, we didn't understand the flaws in the language. So we're fixing that language a little bit, so we're going to be better able to do that. And we're also expanding it to another group of durable medical equipment providers. That's the first thing. The second thing that we're doing is we're going to be making more referrals for collection to the Department of Revenue collections unit. Kind of pursuing federal and state revenue recapture, garnishment, asset seizure. And then the third one that we're going to be doing is getting some money back from the federal government. When we identify an overpayment to a provider, we have to, within a short period of time, give the government their due. So if we identify that we overpaid by $100, we need to pay the federal government $50 of those dollars. However, there's a provision in the federal law that says if we're unable to actually collect on that, then we can go back to the federal government and say we need that $50 back because we were unable to collect on that debt. And we hadn't done that before. So we're going to start doing that. But in order to do some of these things, we need a little bit more horsepower. And so we've got a couple of positions in there. And so those three provisions all kind of go together. And so while the first one is merely this provider enrollment fee that looks like, it's not going to be recovering much money. All told, all three of those together will net us, in the first biennium, they'll net us about almost $900,000, and the second biennium, a little over $900,000. So I'll just stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kirby. Senator Lori, do you have anything else to add, or any members have any questions? Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that $532 fee.
Yes.
Who actually pays that? And is that an individual per person?
Mr. Kirby.
Madam Chair and Senator Clausen, no, individual sole practitioners are excluded from paying this fee. And so the fee, let's see, I have some numbers here. About 1,000 providers will actually have to pay the fee. Out of about 26,000 new enrolling providers, there are multiple exclusions from the fee part of it. Well, there's not an exclusion for our responsibilities to do the pre and post monitoring of these providers. The fees kind of get limited, and so if you paid a fee in another state, you don't pay a fee in Minnesota. If you're a sole practitioner, you don't pay a fee in Minnesota. If you're a member of if you're a physician at a clinic, you don't pay a fee. And so there are lots of exclusions. So it's really limited to organizations that are newly enrolling.
Thank you.
And Mr. Kerber, clarify what the definition of provider is for this section as well?
Madam Chair, these would be providers who are enrolled in the MA reimbursement system. So they're Medicaid providers.
Thank you. Any other questions from members on this section?
Yikes. Except if you're a sole practitioner, you don't, but.
Senator Lori?
You know, one thing that we've been neglecting to do, I know I've gotten a couple of emails on some of these provisions, and we haven't been opening it up to the public, and maybe we should as we go through each one too. Work with us here. We're trying to develop this. Maybe open it up to the public and see if anybody else has issues they'd like to bring forward for our consideration before we move on in a topical area.
Thank you, Senator Lori. Duly noted. Does anybody member of the audience here have any questions?
This is new.
Any testimony they'd like to offer this time? We'll do that moving forward. Thank you, Senator Lori.
Yeah. So the next ACA compliance issue.
This is a summary of his
Okay, thank you. On our list would be the administration and systems resources for all healthcare coverage expansions. Those will largely be found on the governor's change, page 14. And Assistant Commissioner Leitz is back to describe this item to us. Do you know what section and article and section it's in as well?
Actually, no, there is accompanying language with this one, actually. Let me just be fiscal. Request. I'm not sure there's language.
Okay. Maybe in the right. Is there riders at the back? Back here, then?
Is this the change? Is this the change?
Go ahead and present it. So it's Governor's Change, page 14.
Madam Chair, the implementation of the Affordable Care Act does require some significant changes to the state's Medicaid program and to some of our other insurance affordability programs. What this item does is to increase the administrative capacity of the department in a way that will allow us to implement the law, continue to make sure that we have continuity of coverage for individuals, provide good customer services to Minnesotans, and it requires an investment to do that. So this item requests an investment of $4.6 million for fiscal years 14 and 15 and $6.7 million in fiscal years 16 and 17. We are estimating that an additional 230,000 Minnesotans will be in public programs over our current levels by 2016. And this will require additional administrative and system costs to fully implement and sustain our customer service. Most importantly, making sure that enrollees are able to get onto the programs and maintain coverage, and to provide support and training to our county partners, to healthcare providers, health plans, and other community organizations who will be involved in the implementation. We will be increasing our capacity in a number of areas. There are costs that are related to new computer system interfaces and continued system support of larger populations of Minnesota healthcare program enrollees. These systems include our Medicaid Management Information System, the new IT system through MNsure, and the call center technology. Changes are also needed to our current DHS systems to interface with the new MNsure IT system and to meet what we anticipate will be an increased demand. We're also building an online training tool for providers as well as MNsure and public program eligibilities workers, including the counties, and new call center technology for MNsure, for Minnesota Care, and the DHS provider call centers to handle what we do anticipate to be a significant increase in volume due to increased enrollment and additional customer service demand. We also would anticipate that we will have these needs to support increased healthcare claims processing for Medicaid and Minnesota Care due to significant increases in enrollment as well as new interfaces with the new MNsure eligibility and IT system. And we also are anticipating changes needed to make to our current DHS systems to interface with the MNsure IT system and meet the increased demand on online training for tools for providers, new call center technology, and supported increased healthcare claims processing for medical assistance in Minnesota Care. One thing that I wanted to note is that this is something that's being done jointly. DHS has systems that are antiquated. We're using this opportunity to jointly build an IT system with MNsure to determine eligibility, do enrollment into programs, and do case management for the insurance assistance programs that will be operating. Finally, Madam Chair, there are some additional administrative demands that will be on the agency from a non-systems perspective, just a pure body perspective to handle the increased enrollment. There's a number of new activities or increased activities that will be occurring. Those include increased oversight and monitoring activities to ensure compliance with our eligibility program rules. There's going to be a fair amount of training that's going to need to occur with the counties, with the MNsure staff, with navigators, brokers, and others involved in the application processing system. Additional reporting and technical assistance and training for county, tribal, and DHS eligibility staff to implement the new eligibility rules and the new eligibility IT system. Hospitals, as I mentioned earlier, will be eligible to conduct presumptive eligibility, so we'll need to provide support and training to those hospitals to be able to do that. We do anticipate a fairly significant increase in call volume to the Medicaid and Minnesota Care member help desk, as well as the need to conduct education, enrollment, and health plan work that is currently being done by the counties and to support that. We always have issues resolving around provider, county, and managed care organization concerns. We anticipate those increasing substantially simply because of the enrollment increases that will be occurring under the law. And then finally, we do anticipate that there will be, because new people are coming onto the programs in fairly significant numbers, increased caseloads for our ombudsman offices, for our managed care ombudsman, as well as the support desks that help support providers who are providing services and individuals who are seeking assistance in enrollment or with their programs.
Commissioner, can you walk through the FTEs for these different functions that you've mentioned? It seems like you're really ramping up different areas. I just want to have an idea of how many people we're talking about here.
I'm checking, Madam Chair, to see if I have that information. Otherwise, we can certainly get it for the committee. Madam Chair, I can tell you at a high level the number of FTEs is an increase of 52 FTEs that the department is requesting here. As to the specifics, we do have that broken down. I'm just not certain I have that with me at the table. That is correct. Madam Chair, the 52 that are being requested relate to the implementation of the full Affordable Care Act portion of this.
Commissioner, I'm looking at the governor's budget proposal tracking on page 2 out of 13, and it goes and has a series of FTEs starting from 24.5, then the 52 you mentioned, 59, 61, and it's all under healthcare administration.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
So my question is, where are the other ones versus just the 52 you mentioned are under DHS purview, and the rest will be elsewhere?
Madam Chair, my understanding from the tracking, so the 52 that you're seeing, the numbers that you're tracking within the tracking sheet relate to the FTEs that are there for the implementation activities related to the Affordable Care Act. So those would fall within the healthcare administration at DHS.
And then the rest of them?
The rest of them are,
you know, I'm not certain. Madam Chair, maybe I could, in ask for a breakdown from DHS of exactly where we will find FTEs in this entire budget, and MDH as well. I guess I know that this will be a matter that the committee will come back to over and over and over again and ask, exactly where FTEs are and the functions that they support and the rationale for them in a separate document. And maybe I would request that that be prepared just so that we can have something to refer back to.
Madam Chair and Senator Lordy, we'll certainly do that. Just to clarify, Madam Chair, the line that you're referring to, I think, where it has 24.5, 52, 15, those are just fiscal year, I think, ramp-ups of the staffing. And so I just wanted to clarify that that's what that was. I do think that we would be very happy to provide that. We recognize that that'll be an area of interest as to where those FTEs would be for and what activities they'll be doing. So that's a request we'll certainly take care of for you.
Thank you, Commissioner. That makes perfect sense now. And I believe Senator Benson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. So 52 FTEs, how many were already included in the exchange budget?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, none of these FTEs would have been included in that.
Okay, so Senator Madam Benson? Chair and Mr. Lights, we just passed the exchange, Minsure. Isn't it the exchange's responsibility to support itself? I mean, support and train counties, HICS staff, navigators, brokers, association processing. I thought that was all over there, and now it's over here.
Commissioner Lights?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the way obviously that the affordable that this works is that the Medicaid program, while you're absolutely right, there will be certain eligibility determinations that will be made through the MNSURE. There still is a very strong need for us to work with the counties to ensure that as the Medicaid agency, we're working with the exchange to allow them to be able to do those determinations and help them understand what the rules are around that. So there are certain cross functions that are there. There is a certain level of the word I want to use here is cross function that occurs between the two, between Medicaid and between the insurance exchange. What we've tried to scope out here is what's necessary within our agency to be able to do the work that is maintaining a the medical assistance program, the Medicaid program. There obviously will be staffing that'll occur at MNsure. What this really represents is our portion of ensuring that those two pieces work together. The other thing I would just say is that the work with the counties is one that will be is really falls very much within the purview and responsibility of the Medicaid agency in a lot of ways. And so what when we talk about sort of the needs around training with staff at the county, that's a relationship we have now. We simply anticipate, and I think I have tried to do our due diligence around it, estimating how much that's going to grow and with the new enrollment and making sure that we have sufficient levels of staffing to do that.
Madam Chair and Mr. Leitz, then, okay, it says right here, support and train HICS staff, navigators, and brokers. There is no HICS staff, navigators, or brokers right now. All of them should be covered by the exchange. We don't need them here. They should all be in the exchange. If there's genuine MA functionality that's occurring in human services, I understand that. But if it's related to or caused by the exchange pays for it. We don't need to double dip. You can call it cross-functionality. Some people call it redundancy. That's fine. But there's a point where we've got to squeeze a little bit. Okay, and you talk about counties, training the counties. Anoka County is looking at $1.4 million over a couple of years. This doesn't even come close. So the counties are either going to have an unfunded mandate or these numbers don't make sense. The exchange has to pull its own weight. It's got a massive amount of funding. So if we're looking for places to squeeze, I'd start here and tell them they're responsible for training the counties to work with the exchange. They're responsible for training their own staff. I'm looking at the second bullet point on page 14. They're responsible for training navigators. They're responsible for training brokers and the application processing entities. If it touches the exchange trains them.
Commissioner Leitz.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, well, I understand the points that you're making. I just do want to point out that there is a great deal of interrelation between the exchange and the Medicaid program. And I understand the point that you're making about the funding that the exchange has received, but I also just want to make sure that the committee understands that we will be working very, very closely with MNsure in the implementation moving into 2014, and that will require us to help the staff at the county level, at a provider level, in other state agencies as well, to actually be able to implement all the pieces here. And there are a lot of very complex pieces that relate to the Medicaid expansions and changes as it relates to eligibility and the changes in how applications are being accepted and renewed and all of those things that I've went through earlier. So while I understand your point, I simply want to point out that there is still a fair amount of necessity for there to be capacity to be able to do those pieces.
And Senator Benson? Madam Chair, Commissioner Leitz, I understand the need to reprogram some of our legacy systems to feed into MSure and to interact. I understand that, and I understand that's going to take some time and it's going to take some talent. It's going to take some resources. I understand that counties have people in place and they're going to need some training. But were it not for the exchange, they wouldn't need the training. So the exchange can pay for it. If there are other things we need to do, if we need to redesign forms, if we need to put in a new Maxis system, I understand that. I think it's in this budget somewhere, and I can't wait to see it. But we just spent a boatload of money, and now I'm hearing we're going to have to spend some more to make this exchange work. And so with as tight as these targets are, I'd start here.
Commissioner or Senator Lori?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Benson, you know, I think with the additional insight about the FTEs that are requested in this budget, and we are all going to be looking at that carefully and will, frankly, be wanting to squeeze a little bit. I do think, though, that there is we have to be careful not to conflate the Affordable Care Act, which is much broader than the exchange, with the exchange. And so the Affordable Care Act itself, whether or not Minnesota built an exchange, imposes the Magi standard on us. And so the counties would need to be trained on the Magi standard. And DHS is still our single state agency in charge of our federal relationship with the governor, I mean with the federal center, CMS, for the shared state and federal partnership we know as medical assistance. And so a certain level of continued engagement and interaction and compliance is actually warranted and to be expected in the HHS budget beyond that which is done at the exchange. But I can assure you we will all be looking carefully at the requests for FTEs in this budget. But we do need to be careful not to conflate the two. The ACA compliance is broader than what we did with Minnesota building our own exchange. And much of this functionality would have been required whether or not we built our own exchange or ceded to the feds to build an exchange.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Lori, I understand that. I understand Minsure is a small subset of the overall ACA puzzle. Second bullet point says support and train counties, HIC staff, navigators, and brokers. HIC staff, navigators, and brokers are only in Minsure. They're not in the rest of the ACA. So whatever math was involved in the second bullet point gets shifted to the exchange, and you don't have to figure out where to find that money then. I completely understand the bottom bullet on that page. Additional staff needed to map logic and interfaces. Totally get that. I understand that's a DHS responsibility. Increased reporting needs. Totally get that as I'm working up from the bottom. I can understand these things cost money and they need to be done. But I feel like there's a giant shell game going on with IT and staff here, and I'm just trying to push so we get some clarity.
And, Commissioner, I also have a question regarding minutes, which is the consolidation of IT, and how does that interact with what we're talking about here? Commissioner?
Madam Chair, could you just be a little bit more specific with your question?
Well, because I know there's been a consolidation with minutes and how we're putting all the IT sources in this entity or government agency area, but then we're also creating what we're creating with what you just went through. So how do the two work together, interact? And
Madam Chair, the primary way that the two interact is that what really got consolidated was the staffing portion of things. So the folks who do the programming, who do the systems work, still are a part of the Minute staff now, but they still work on the systems that the agencies use to do their business. So that's kind of the way that the arrangement works, with Minute sort of having a the overarching responsibility for making sure that those projects get done, but they're done on behalf of the agencies who are updating their systems or maintaining their systems. And in this case, it would be systems that we would be expanding and improving under this bill. So that's kind of how the two interact.
And just to follow up on that, the FTEs would be in DHS, not Minutes staff.
I believe what's being requested here would be operations for to pay for the staff that do the work at Minute. On the systems piece.
Any other questions? Senator Claussen?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Is it possible that these are really not new positions? There are people already there that they're being shifted as we look at reorganizing the health care plan for the state? Or are these actually new positions?
Commissioner Lights.
Madam Chair, Senator, these would be new positions.
Any other questions, Senator Sharon?
Well, I have a question, but it's not related to the I'd like to, it's about a little bit different subject that I'd like to ask before we move to drug reimbursement. So whenever you're finished with the administration and systems resources, I just want to ask Commissioner Leitz a question before he leaves, because I didn't get to ask it before. I was eating an orange in the corner.
So if no other members have any questions regarding this portion, anybody in the public audience wants to either comment or testify or ask questions regarding this section? Hearing none, Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Commissioner Leitz, before you disappear, I was listening to a question that I heard our chair ask, and I wasn't sure if I understood your answer, and maybe it's because I didn't understand the question, but I thought it was in relationship to the transferring of the population to medical assistance. It's the populations described as pregnant women
and children up to 275%.
Yes, and being transferred to medical assistance, where the service system is essentially the same, but we're able to draw down a match from the federal government. But so the question is, rather than have them be on Minnesota Care and then paid for out of the provider tax. So I understand that I think it's the right thing to do. But what was unclear to me and what I thought you were asking was whether or not the money that we have in the Minnesota Care program, it'll cost us a dollar to keep them. This is just an example. I use small numbers. A dollar in the Minnesota Care program to provide the service, but it only costs the state 50 cents if they move over to medical assistance because of the match. Is that essentially correct? Out of the state fund, and then we draw down whatever percentage we can have. So those numbers might not be exact, but essentially that's what we're accomplishing here. So the question I have is whether or not the money that we transfer out of the Minnesota Care Fund to the general fund to cover our portion of those costs, if all of that money, is that all the money that we're currently using to serve that population going into the general fund? And if it is, it seems to me that there's more money there than is needed to serve the population under medical assistance. So if that's true, is all the money going with them that serve that population now into the general fund? And if it is not needed to serve that population, where is that money going from that was in the Minnesota Care Fund? Do you follow my question?
I think you're a lot more eloquent than I was with my initial question, but Commissioner Leitz.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, I think what you're asking is, as we transfer individuals from the Minnesota Care Program into the Medicaid program, where it is a general fund funded exercise out of Minnesota Care, where it's a healthcare access funded exercise, that frees up savings in the healthcare access fund, which is used to offset the general fund costs that are associated with the movement of people from Minnesota Care into the medical assistance program or into Medicaid. What I've been talking about is sort of a net cost of the two combined. So you have a general fund increase for individuals, both for the transfer people plus the new people who are coming in who are currently eligible but not enrolled, who have come out because of the requirement to have insurance coverage. And then you have a savings to the healthcare access fund as a result of that movement. And so the in a sense what you have is offsetting costs with the access fund, helping to cover some of the costs that would otherwise occur in the general fund.
Madam Chair?
She's assuming that
yes, Mr.
Madam Chair, and Senator Sharon, let me just clarify something that Senator Laurie just whispered to me. Was there an assumption here that we were not receiving match on the Minnesota Care populations, or that we were receiving match? Both of these populations would be a federal matched population.
The question that was the less important part of what I was trying to say. I was trying to ascertain whether or not all of the money that's currently being spent on that population out of the Minnesota Care Program, is all of that money transferred with this population into the general fund and utilized specifically for that population? Or is there additional revenue that's going to be utilized for other purposes in the general fund?
Sure.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, the population that the transfer related to these populations is related to those populations.
Ms. Albright.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I think the answer to your question is no. The money in the governor's proposal that is saved in the health care access fund for this particular part of the governor's budget stays in the health care access fund.
But
Senator Lurie?
And just to highlight a point, that I think that the net cost of these individuals would be the same whether they were covered in Minnesota Care with a health care access fund or in Medicaid with a state general fund. But we're bringing in a lot larger population into Medicaid than were covered because there was eligible but not stepping forward families in the Minnesota Care that are going to be stepping forward with the mandate and with the end of the four-month waiting and the other issues that were barriers to actually enrolling in the Minnesota Care program. So that's a couple of the factors for the increased costs as well. But for each individual person, it was a 50% match under Minnesota Care. It's just that the non-federal share was covered with Healthcare Access Fund, and there will be a 50% match in Medicaid, but it'll be general fund. We'll likely transfer the Healthcare Access Fund to cover this population into the general fund to make that up.
And Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, just to clarify, I apologize if I misunderstood your question. There are some transfers that occur, and I think I was just referring to those pieces of it, but you're – yes.
That there are – broader transfers out
as part of the larger package.
As part of the larger package, broader transfers out of the healthcare access fund to support general fund spending.
And, Senator Lurie, can you remind us how much those transfers are?
Maybe Mr. Albrecht could give us a better picture of the use of healthcare access fund in the governor's budget and how it relates to coverage of populations formerly covered by Minnesota Care.
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, and members, in the governor's budget, which is described on a budget page called New Minnesota Care, I don't believe that these details are described there, but in the tracking sheet you can see that the governor is moving what is currently general fund spending into the health care access fund for three population groups. And the total and the three population groups are 19 to 20-year-olds, legal non-citizens, and adults without kids. And the total for all of that is effectively a $414 million transfer out of the health care access fund to the general fund.
Senator Lurie?
Madam Chair and Mr. Albrecht, I believe, though, that that's the total transfer to support these populations, and many of that, much of that is legitimately following individuals from coverage in the historic Minnesota Care into there, and there's some portion that isn't really following those individuals. My recollection was about $296 million of the $414 of transfers. I try to track this carefully myself as well because, I mean, the Healthcare Access Fund was set up for a specific purpose to cover healthcare needs of low-wage, hardworking Minnesota families to make sure that they had availability of coverage. And, I think that in this reform world, it's, I don't have a problem with those that historic function of the healthcare access fund being used for those population, the same populations as they transfer over to Medicaid. But beyond that, it is not entirely in keeping with the intent of the healthcare access fund creation. And so I do try to track that, and I do believe that the number that I've seen when you go through the budget pages is in the ballpark of $414 million of healthcare access fund transfers over to the general fund. And about when I do the numbers, looks like you can track populations to about 296 million of that to tie it back to
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, that's math I haven't done. So
okay. Well, okay.
And for members, we're looking at page 13 of 13 for the budget proposal tracking, and it would be lines 581, 582, and 583 are the funds that would be transferred from the health care access fund to the general fund. That's where you'd find the numbers on page 13. Any other questions?
So, Senator Lurie, that number was 296?
It's actually 263. I just pulled it out of my pocket,
I was going to correct you. I was going to correct you. That was a huge mistake. But so 263 of 400. So yeah. Do you have a sense of where the rest of it is going?
Well, in my view of it, it's in the broader package here, and we do have the governor had tight budget targets to meet as well, and we have to make some choices on what we do with funds and it becomes difficult to track beyond that point other than 413-14 million of transfers from the healthcare access fund into the general fund. I can, when I go through it, justify over half of that in tracking individuals formerly served or eligible for Minnesota Care, and then I lose track of it at some point. And the way I look at it is it's just used for the Health and Human Services budget, at least.
Thank you. Okay. Members? Is there anybody from the audience who wants to testify or ask any questions at this point? Hearing none, I think we'll move forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the next ACA and the last ACA-related item is appeals that you will find on page 131 of the governor's change pages. Johnson here with us from DHS.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, Chuck Johnson, Chief Financial and Operating Officer with DHS. The appeals piece for the Affordable Care Act is on budget page 131. There is no bill language that relates to this item. It's just a budget request. This is a new request from the governor's supplemental budget. The request is for $1.26 million for added appeals judges to DHS to address the issues that will come to us, appeals through the ACA, including the volume of appeals from the increased caseloads that we've just talked about through the expansions Commissioner Lights outlined. As by way of background, DHS hears and decides appeals on all of our public assistance programs, Medicaid, Minnesota Care, the SNAP program, all of our cash programs, and so forth. We have about 10,000 appeals a year. We have 20 appeals judges who are currently working at DHS doing this work. People have the right to appeal any decision that's made that adversely affects them. A lot of these are eligibility-related appeals. Someone's determined not to be eligible, they appeal. We hear the appeal and work to identify whether the case was handled properly and make a determination on that. Under the Affordable Care Act and under current federal and state law, the appeals that will come to from Medicaid and Minnesota Care will continue to be the responsibility of the Medicaid agency. That is, continue to be the responsibility of DHS. We're estimating with the expansions for medical assistance, which Commissioner Lice just outlined, the increased caseload from streamlined eligibility, the additional kids from expanding to 275, plus the expansion to adults that this body already passed before during February. In addition, the governor's proposed continuation of the Minnesota Care program for the population between 130 and 200 will add over 200,000 more cases to the Minnesota Care and MA program, between 200,000 and 300,000 cases over time, which will increase the number of appeals that we'll need to hear at DHS. We're estimating an increase of 3,000 appeals that we'll be hearing by the time this is fully phased in. As a result, we are requesting additional staff to handle those appeals. We also believe the appeals, and this is one of these things where it's kind of tricky to judge how many appeals we'll get.
We get a little less than 1% of cases appealing now in Minnesota Care, but it will be easier to appeal under the Affordable Care Act. You can appeal orally, by telephone, or online. Massachusetts' experience when they implemented over the first year was a rate of almost 2%. So we've estimated around the 1%, but we are concerned about the staffing for this. We are requesting 13 FTEs. This would be 10 human service judges, one manager to oversee those 10 judges, who is essentially a co-chief judge who does the final determinations and all the decisions, and two support staff. We think using support staff really helps us be more efficient in how we manage the volume of appeals that we deal with at DHS. And so that request brings about $1.27 million of expense. This is a general fund cost for the next biennium.
Members, any questions?
Ooh, an A for brevity.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions from the audience? Hearing none, I think we can keep moving forward.
The last of the items on tonight's agenda is the 340B drug reimbursement program. Members will find that as change item page 19 in the governor's budget. And we have Assistant Commissioner Leitz again.
Madam Chair, members, the 340B it's in section Article 7.
Article 7, section 2 is where members might find the actual language.
Madam Chair, the 340B drug reimbursement program is a federal program that was originally
page 227 in the big document if members are.
Thank you, Senator Lurie.
Yep. You're welcome.
That was originally established a number of years ago to allow certain safety net providers to purchase drugs at a discounted rate with the intention of having state Medicaid programs share in some of the savings from those discounted drugs that are purchased. At the time the program was established, there was a fairly small number of entities who were eligible to purchase these drugs. And basically what the department did at the time was to essentially have one-off agreements with those organizations. They purchased the drug at a discounted rate. DHS agreed to a rate that was somewhat higher to reimburse them for the drugs so that they had some margin. Since the drugs that they were purchasing and the price that DHS was paying was actually below what the retail price was, we saved money as a state Medicaid agency. Two things have happened over time. One is that more and more of these entities have become eligible for 340B reimbursement or to be a part of the 340B program, which allows them to purchase drugs at a discounted rate. That's also become very administratively difficult to administer on a one-off basis. And we've been strongly encouraged by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to put in place, and they've done this with all the states, a standardized policy around how we do reimbursement to entities that are purchasing drugs at a discount. The second thing that's happened is that manufacturers in Medicaid programs have started to offer substantial rebates for drugs that are purchased for Medicaid programs. And so while back when 340B was originally established, the retail price was quite a bit higher than the rate DHS was paying and the rate that the 340B entities were getting drugs at, because of the discounts that we now receive on drugs that are purchased in a retail setting, the amount that we're paying for 340B drugs reimbursing to the entities is actually now above what we actually pay for retail drugs. And so the original goal of the program to allow entities to purchase drugs at a discount and pass some of those savings on to Medicaid programs isn't now being met. And so what this proposal attempts to do is to really do a couple things. Put in place that standardized methodology that would meet what the request of CMS and to make the program more administratively, our ability to administer the program more administratively doable, and also to mimic, in a sense, what the rebate would have been had we been able to apply for the rebate. One of the things about the 340B program is that if drugs are being purchased through 340B, those drugs are ineligible for rebate, and so we can't double dip, as it were. And so what we'd like to be able to do in this program is to be able to have a standardized methodology for paying for 340B purchased drugs or the entities that purchase those drugs, and to also achieve the savings that we would otherwise be able to achieve if we had purchased those drugs at retail and received the discount. This does make a modest change to the original this was included in the original governor's budget. The supplemental budget makes a small change that we made in response to some stakeholder feedback, which changes essentially the original proposal, which was to use the wholesale acquisition cost minus 44% for the payment rate to the DHS MA allowable rate less 33%. We do think that this proposal will make it more administratively simple for both the department and the providers to participate in. We have heard from a number of providers on this proposal, since it does have some impacts because of it is a savings proposal. I think the department's willing to work with those providers, but we do know that this is something that will be under a fair amount of scrutiny from CMS, as well as from those who watch how we're doing our Medicaid purchasing.
Any questions from members? Any questions from the audience? Section is quite open. We do have someone from the audience. Please come forward and state your name for the record. I know.
Madam Chairman, my name is Charles Cooper. I'm a pharmacist. I work for Fairview, and I manage the 340B program on behalf of the University of Minnesota Medical Center. I've actually worked with this program since its inception in 1992. I've actually worked at three of the major providers, safety net providers, in the city's Regents Hospital, Hennepin County Medical Center, and the University of Minnesota. I think we have no issue at all with trying to make a consistent payment program. I think the safety net providers, and for the University of Minnesota, safety net really means that we have a fairly high number of very significantly ill patients that are benefiting under this program. Excuse me. We provide hemophilia treatment programs. We provide programs for enzyme replacement therapies that, in some cases, are hard to find in the country, let alone in the upper Midwest. The reimbursement rates that we have under this program right now that are being proposed, even amended, for our top five drugs that are administered to patients would actually put us at a reimbursement that's below our cost. So we still want to make sure we have that conversation, but I think we still need to make sure that we have a workable formula for both. Now, what we do with the savings with these programs, especially for our patient population, is that these patients are very sick and very fragile. In many cases, they need some services beyond just dispensing or administering the medication. So for our hemophilia patients and our enzyme patients, we make sure that we have a safety net around them, and we work very closely with our providers to make sure that they, A, get their medications, because that's the benchmark of the program. We want to make sure that regardless of their ability to pay, that they get their medications. But, B, that they also have the support structure to make sure that they take their medications the way they're supposed to and are monitored. And that's where the expense really comes in, a lot of it, besides just the administrative dispensing the medication and the time and preparation for it. One hemophilia patient that gets out of control at the university that gets admitted, and these, and many of our patients are frequent flyers. They do get sick and they do end up back into the hospital. Costs our inpatient institution, and the total cost of care goes up significantly. It doesn't take long for one hemophilia patient to rack up a seven-digit figure bill in the hospital. So we try to set up programs around that, and that's part of what we do for using the savings that we've gained in the program. And the savings that, you know, that's why we like to make sure that we're both sharing that savings in the program and come up with a reasonable number. So we have no problem, I don't think, with the issue of making a consistent payment, but I think we really do have to work hard, roll up our sleeves, and take the time to make sure it's going to work for both parties. Because if we do take the cuts that it looks like we are going to be taking in this program under this proposal, some of those services are going to have to go away. That's pretty much the bottom line.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper, for your testimony. Anybody have any questions for Mr. Cooper? Thank you. Senator Lurie?
I don't know if there was anyone else from the audience on 340B. With that, I will say I have heard much about this provision since its initial rollout from DHS as well, and we'll be working hard with stakeholders to try to make sure that it's something that's palatable for all parties and that whatever we do can work.
Senator Sharon?
Since you started to speak to what you're hearing about this, have those impacted by that been involved in this process throughout, you know, Senator Lurie, and whenever there's a trying to stabilize, what they're talking about, a consistent stability when rates have been negotiated differently for providers. Is everybody sort of still in a reasonable range, or many going up, some going down? How is this all being laid out, and are the providers, I guess I assumed that from the last testimony that providers had been involved and engaged and understand the process at least, and by and large are aware that this has to be done, even though rates are probably still too low. So I guess my question is, have they been involved, and are there winners and losers in the deal?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, you know, from my tracking of the conversation, and I guess we'll have additional testimony as well, this has been a fairly abbreviated conversation, really, in terms of some of these major reforms that we do. I mean, the guidance came out in October of 2012 recommending states take a look at this and make sure that we have a uniform payment system for our 340B drug reimbursement program. And there are real issues why the feds are encouraging states to take a serious look at that. And there have been conversations through this period between the Department of Human Services and the provider community, the 340B eligible provider community. I don't think that we're at a place right now where there's broad acceptance that we're at a good place yet, and we're going to keep trying to get to that by the time we get done with this bill, and we'll see where that takes us. But I think that those conversations are continuing, and it looks like Mr. Godfrey, who's no stranger to this room either, who's now with HCMC, probably has some additional insights into the question, which was, how has the communication with providers been?
And Mr. Godfrey, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is David Godfrey, representing Hennepin County and HCMC. To address just in terms of the provider engagement, we did attend one meeting that the department hosted to talk about the proposal. It was about a week or two after the budget was released. And since then, we've had some email communication with the department, but we really haven't had a situation where we sat down and really, as Mr. Cooper said, rolled up our sleeves and tried to hammer this out in kind of what we would think is a collaborative fashion. I would also say, to answer Senator Sharon's question in terms of how the variation across providers and the impact, that the Hospital Association has been very helpful in terms of collecting the payment rate data so we could have a good starting point at which we can begin developing what that rate is. Our interest is, as Mr. Cooper said, is to come up with a standardized rate across this provider type, 340B providers. However, our goal is also to keep as much of the money in the program as we have today so we can continue to do the charity care and other things, that positive things like MTM, that we do with this money. And I will say that based on MHA can correct me, but I believe the average rate cut that the 340B providers would take under this proposal, at least the hospital ones, is 34%. And in the history of the Medicaid program, I don't think any provider type has ever been cut 34%. And so we're trying to work with the department in terms of getting around what their federal compliance issues are, but we don't think they need to take that big of a chunk out of our payment rates.
Thank you, Mr. Godfrey. Senator Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in regards to that, this is the unintended consequences. And I think this is an area where you need to really tread carefully and thoughtfully, because that's exactly, especially in the pharmacy area, where we are seeing some shortages in some areas and other issues that we have spoken about before. So I'm glad to hear that there are those conversations and that there is that involvement, because I think that's exactly what has been mentioned here is something we need to be cautious about. So I'm glad to hear that. There'll be more conversations, and yes, as we have time with this bill, sounds like we might have some adjustments or other things, and that sounds like a good thing to do. 34% is certainly not necessary.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. If anybody wants to respond. Any questions? Any other testimony from the audience or questions? Hearing none, I think that might be where we're end tonight.
Well, I think it is where we're going to end tonight, Madam Chair and members. Maybe I don't think I'm going to try to make a motion to get these items that we discussed tonight laid on the table. I'd have a hard time moving article and section number. We'll just continue this conversation. We've published the next couple of hearings and the items from 1034 that we will cover, the topical items, and we've tried to match those with bills within the committee that day as well, but to try to give a little lead time for people trying to schedule, we do have a tentative plan for the next week or so for the topical areas that we plan to cover in Senate File 1034 beyond what's been published to date that I guess we're willing to share at this point. On Friday, it's our intention to work on chemical and mental health issues on the Friday morning hearing. On Monday, that's Friday of this week. On Monday of next week, we wouldn't take up 1034 items until the evening, and we would be trying to work through the children and family issues within the 1034 on that day. On Wednesday evening would be the next time we would take up 1034, and we would be trying to get through the state-operated services and the Office of the Inspector General issues. I see some faces. You know, again, this is not set in stone. I know if there's topic areas that members absolutely need to be present for and won't be able to be there, you know, maybe somebody else can entertain your questions, or maybe we can make adjustments, but this is what we're planning so far. Thursday morning would be continuing care articles and provisions. Friday would be health. Friday morning would be the health care provisions, and we will continue to hear other bills as well. We still have, by our current count, about 90 that we need to get through during the days and other times during that time. And we need to be done with our entire omnibus. That means the amendment, take it on, and have the provisions that we're going to carry by the 16th, which is the following Tuesday. A lot of work ahead of us. Hopefully that's a little bit of a heads up. If members want me to repeat that, I certainly can. I don't know if people were in time, but
Senator Lori, I believe Stacey Weeks will be emailing the members yes. with that information, and we might be bringing treats as well.
Treats?
Treats.
Treats?
To entice members to be here on time
right.
so we can get through the 90 bills.
All right.
Hopefully they're alcohol.
So thank you with that, Senator Lori. Senator Rosen? Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, since you did bring up treats, I would like to remind Senator Lori that Senator Sharon did provide us with pizza.
Pizza.
With what?
Yeah, pizza.
That's right.
She did. Well, she's a better person than I. I'm gluten-free. I can't have pizza.
Hey, I'm missing out on
it. Senator Lori, thank you, and thank you, members. I guess pizza may not be on order unless you want gluten-free.
Madam Chair. Madam
Senator
Chair.
Rosen.
Senator Lori, are you expecting to meet on Tuesday? Next week, Tuesday evening?
Yes, Tuesday.
Oh, I did not hear that. Okay.
Evening of next.
So every evening next week.
Tuesday then. Day, not evening.
Oh, okay.
And again, early yeah, this morning I tried to say we did try to, you know, I'm not sure if we'll be able to do this, but we planned for a fewer number of longer hearings in the evening rather than a moderate length every evening, so that there are some evenings free. And Tuesday of next week, I think, is one that we weren't planning on having a hearing on, because we're going to be spending a lot of time together.
Mm-hmm. Rosen,
we thought a couple of long evenings rather than many shorter ones would be more palatable.
Right now it looks like Monday and Wednesday evenings are the dates that we're doing going
next
on.
Week.
And
Monday and Wednesday.
Evening.
Monday and Wednesday.
Monday and Wednesday. Thank you. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.